Hello and welcome to Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis. This is the slot in the week where we celebrate our wonderfulness, but also have a little laugh at those moments when we wish the ground would open us up. But today I think we're going to get quite a lot of wisdom and a lot of wit, and probably I think my guest will leave the pratfall part of it to me, because this week we're talking to the lovely Bear Rose Gandy, very talented writer, television producer and lecturer. Welcome, Bear Rose. So today, Bear Rose has had a really amazing career, producing films for the BBC and TV. So I'd just like to find out from you, what was your biggest influence?
Hello, Joan. Thank you for inviting me here. I think my biggest influence, I have to say, were my parents.
Yeah.
But we'll talk about them later.
Yes, yes.
But they allowed me. I grew up in a very conservative Zoroastrian Parsi family in Bombay, and at the age of 20 I'd done my BA in English, and I thought, what next?
Yes.
And I wanted to come to England just for an adventure, and they allowed me that opportunity, which I'm very grateful for.
So you studied in India and then came to...
Yeah, I did a second degree in what was then called media studies, which is very unfashionable and politically now, but I think it gave me a wonderful rounded background in understanding the world. And then I had an idea in my mind that I would have a degree in television, because that's what India needed, and I'd go back to India eventually after my studies. But you know how fate takes you. I met a man who then became my husband, and we're not married anymore, but at that time he was a fellow student, and I stayed on in England.
Okay, so was England had you visited the country before you settled
here? I'd visited England in 1970, and I came later in 73. And when I came to London, we'd done the kind of traditional grand tour of Europe with the family all in the car. And then when we arrived in London, I just had this really strong feeling that I would come back. So I didn't bother with any of the kind of conventional tourist places. I'll see all that later. I'm going to come back to the city. This is where I feel at home.
Really?
It was a very, very strong feeling. Yeah.
Because obviously the London of the 70s was so very different to how it is now.
Yeah, and I was a complete and utter Beatle fan. So I went to... I did all my kind of obeisance to the King's Road and Carnaby Street and all that, where what I was missing out as a teenager listening in school about.
Oh, of course.
I was catching up. There was not much of that left behind, but still. And I just thought, oh, I'll be back.
So what was it about the city that drew you to it?
Well, I just felt really comfortable. For instance, when I was in Europe, I would never know where we were, and I'd never kind of just follow my parents around, and we'd be driven here and there, visiting a lot of art galleries, because that's what their background was. And it was only in London that I looked at the map, and I knew we were staying in a artist friend's house in Hampstead, which was lovely.
Oh, how nice.
Yeah, we had this whole house to ourselves. And he was in New York, and he had just given us the house. And I used to walk like a hippie barefoot from Hampstead down to the road. I just remember just feeling very comfortable in London. It felt very familiar. And the language, of course, compared to the continent, you know, being able to speak English. And in those days, people would ask me, how did you learn to speak English? I'd say, well, we were colonized.
Because Hampstead is a very nice part of London, isn't it? It's one of the most beautiful parts of London, very green and lush.
And somebody told me that Peter O'Toole lived up the road, so I'd keep sort of going up and standing outside is waiting for him to come out, but I never glimpsed him.
Well, lots of them live there, don't they? It's a real media lovey part of town. Yeah, I think Boris Johnson lived there at one point. So when did you return to London?
And so that was in 1970, the summer, and then I had to go back and finish my degree in English literature, and I remember my tutor saying, "We keep Indian standard time here," because I was a month late. And then I had to beg to get in, you know, and got in and then did 2 years of my degree in English literature. And then I was at a loose end, really. So then my sister was having a baby. She was married to a Swiss, and she lived in Switzerland. So she said, "Would you come and be my au pair in Switzerland?" So I came over and lived in Zurich for 4 months.
And how did that work out, working for your sister?
Working for my sister was great. I mean, I just had to look after this. I was 20 years old, yeah. And I had this lovely, my most favorite niece, eldest, and, you know, I have to say, she was like my child.
Yeah, so you're surrogate mummy.
Yeah. And so I lived in Zurich. I learned very bad German, Swiss German. And then we went, an English friend of mine, half English, half Indian, was coming to India, and we met up in Switzerland, and we went hitchhiking through Germany. We had some friends and contacts, and then we just hitchhiked and then landed up in Holland, and I lived on a boat for 6 weeks in Holland. I don't know how long, but I knew that that was the end, that I could be very free then, and I would never be that free in London, because somehow people would, there was some anonymity that I loved.
I see. Yeah,
in Amsterdam in 1970. And I remember my sister thought I'd really gone a bit wild. And then we came back, and then I went to London, and somebody, you know, had advised my parents about which university I should go to. And I went to what was then the Polytechnic of Central London, which is now the University of Westminster.
Yes. You enjoyed that?
And I had a great time, yeah. I lived in a basement flat in Chelsea with a whole lot of exiles from South Africa. Very political people who were emigres leaving the South Africa. So I got into this whole world of South African anti-apartheid politics. Uh-huh. Used to be on marches all the time.
Do you think you were anywhere near the Rolling Stones, because they had a flat in Chelsea?
I bumped
they?
Into Mick Jagger.
Did you?
Yes, I went into once to buy a sandwich, and I saw Mick Jagger standing there. That's the closest I got.
Ooh.
I didn't realize that he had a flat.
He eats, does he? You don't imagine he eats. Does anything as human as eating?
But later I did. I used to live down on between the King's Road and the Fulham Road, and this is when I was with what then became my husband. And I didn't have a job. I'd just finished my degree, and I was waitressing, and I was kind of. I'd tell him. He said, "Darling, what did you do today?" He had an interesting job at the overseas development thing. And I'd say, "Well, I went to the laundrette and I saw these strange people, and it was the Sex Pistols. It was right next door."
Washing their bin bags and safety pins.
Yeah, I saw Vivian Westwood wearing Cambridge Rapist T-shirt. I mean, things like that. That would be the high point of my day, telling him about the punks.
Well, it would be the high point of anyone's day, wouldn't it?
But I didn't realise it at the time.
But I have to say, you've lived at some very rarefied addresses in London. As a Londoner, Hampstead and Fulham and Chelsea are the kind of top postcodes, aren't they?
Well, funny you should say Chelsea, because I didn't enjoy my time in London and Chelsea. I felt very much I didn't feel at home there. It was interesting. I mean, first of all, the flat was pretty crummy. It was a bit... And then I lived with an old Indian lady who was a great kind of institution in India. She was a writer, and I lived in her beautiful flat. But of course, we were with her. She adored my ex-husband, you know, and we were there, lodgers in her place. And I always felt a bit not at home. And then when I moved more to Camden, that's when I felt I was at home.
Well, that's very hip and happening, isn't it?
Yeah. I moved to central London, and then...
So where did this, obviously you've done media studies, so you were already on the path, but to become a film producer, I mean, what a lovely thing to have on your CV. How did you make that leap from your degree into the real world?
Yeah, well, I can say that, I have to say that destiny has played a part in my life. I can really, because I was not, I'm not overtly ambitious. I don't have a life plan that I should do this and this. I mean, I remember some people on the course who were very driven, and they knew where they were going to go. And I knew that at that time, 1976, when I graduated, that the jobs that were available in the media at that time were BBC secretaries. And I thought, I haven't struggled, you know, waitressing and doing all these jobs to become a secretary. I just knew I wasn't going to do that. So then I thought, what can I do? And what can I give my skills to? So I thought I'd work for the Community Relations Council. And I kept applying for jobs there, and I didn't get anywhere with that. So I gave up on that, and I taught Bangladeshi women English to kind of alleviate my social conscience. But I couldn't get in there. They were very sort of a bit suspicious of me as an Indian, you know. Yes. So I didn't get very far there. And I remember the 1977 was a very tough year. This is the year I was in the laundrette a lot,
yes,
you know.
I remember.
And
the laundrette years.
Yeah, the laundrette. And then in 1978, there was an opening. I saw it in The Guardian, which I used to look at. And this friend who I used to live with, her daughter, really helped me get my CV in shape. And there was a job opening at the British Film Institute saying maternity leave, 9 months job. At the distribution department. I thought, God, that's my dream job. I'm going to get in there. And I did, because when I did the interview there, I said that I was interested in Indian cinema and that I was obviously from India. And I made sort of very pompous statements that I didn't like Satyajit Ray, which I take back now, that he was much too conventional. I was into a more radical cinema, yes, and stuff like, yes, that. And they gave me the job.
Fantastic. So how long? So,
then the person whose maternity, yes, cover was doing never came back.
Brilliant. Just what you wanted.
Yes. And so I had the job. And I have to say, I kind of died and went to heaven in that job. It was just fantastic. It was the last years before sort of Thatcherism and stuff like that. So there was still money coming into public institutions, yes, like the BFI. And we worked with all the people who were really passionate about cinema. Yeah. And I learned about cinema there. I went to evening class, and I did a proper degree in film studies, and then subsequently taught. And there were so many people. So you'd learn about Japanese cinema from somebody's passion. You'd learn, my boss knew about British cinema, Powell and Pressburger, and then the Hollywood, all the people, the German emigres, you know, somebody else's passion was that, then the Western, Anthony Mann. You know, I just learned about a whole, and then the NFT, you got free tickets being a member of the BFI. So I'd go.
National Film Theatre.
National Film Theatre. Mm-hmm. I'd go 8 times a week to the film theatre.
How wonderful. What a privilege.
Yeah, I'd cycle down to work, which was in Dean Street, and then cycle down across Waterloo Bridge to the National Film Theatre, watch these films, you know, and then come home. And that was the life in those days.
That doesn't sound like work to me, Bea Rose, at all.
The actual work was kind of publicity and documentation for regional film, yes, theatres. So we had to get all the kind of... So again, I had to study, you know, go to the library and get out. And it's interesting because those people are my friends, the longest running friends. All those people, we have a book club still going in London.
Lovely. I was going to say to you, I bet you made some great contacts. And
great,
some great
friends.
Lifelong,
yeah,
friends.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because we all had our first jobs. We were in our mid-20s. And, you know, now we're in our 60s. Mm.
But it sounds like a golden time for you.
Yeah, it was. And then it kind of came to an end. I felt I wasn't being pushed enough. And so
How long were you there?
So I was there till 82, from 78 to 82. And then in 82, that was a year when I decided to go and do a PGC so that I could teach film.
I see. You lecture in that now, don't you?
Yeah.
Is that for the BFI as well?
Well, I was going to teach in school, but then once I realized I wasn't made to be a school teacher. So then again, fortunately, I was headhunted to work at the British Board of Film Classification, the censor board,
yes,
because that had opened up and they needed Hindi people who could speak Hindi. And I felt a bit of a fraud because my Hindi is not my first language, even though I'm Indian, because in India we've lost, I mean, my community particularly, we speak English much more fluently than we do Hindi. But I mean, it's fine.
It was good enough, yeah.
It was, you know, it got I got by.
Because I'm always fascinated when you sit in the cinema and you see that board of censor, the certificate comes out of there, the little scrawly signature. And I just have this vision of people sitting in these darkened theatres watching these films that probably got no interest in whatsoever and then having to classify them. What's it like? How many do you have to watch a week? Is there a commitment?
You have to do, in those days, now it's all changed, so I'm going to talk about my time till 95, and then it's changed since then. Because we were all meant to be part-timers, so we all had to have other jobs. Now, I was an exception in the sense that I had some film contacts. I was already working for Channel 4. I was starting to work as an independent, which I'll talk about later. Mm. And I was allowed to do this job. And you had to do 3 days a week. So if you were doing films in the theatre, you watched two films plus a short. And if you watched videos, you do about three videos a day. And Hindi films were so long, so we would do two.
So you say so long, so how long?
Sometimes 3 to 3.5 hours.
Oh, goodness.
So that took you into, you know.
And are you scribbling, making notes the whole time?
So you had a big log. We had these big red books, mm-hmm. which were our logs. And you had to take running times on all the problematic. You're trained for 3 months to do the standards. And that is about all animals act, what is acceptable in terms of swear words. That's what the British are very hot on, what was called manners, you know.
Yes.
So what you couldn't use certain words for the U category, for the PG category,
yes.
and all that. And then violence. And then you had to make your case if you wanted to push the category up or down.
Did it go to a board of censors,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, it went to once a month. Then the senior management would look at our reports. Then you had to write reports.
Yes.
In those days, there were no computers, so some pool of secretaries used to type them out. You'd handwrite them and then they'd type it out.
Make it look beautiful.
Yeah, and then the management would look at it and say, I mean, one of my big gaffes was I missed the F word in The Medicine Man, the Sean Connery movie.
Oh, that's your claim to fame, is it?
Oh, it was a claim to shame, I should say.
No.
and then I was also, one of the other controversial decisions I was involved in was Mrs. Doubtfire, the Robin Williams film.
Yes.
Me and my co-examiner just got it into our heads that we wanted to give Hollywood a punch in the nose.
Oh, said, go on. What did you do, Vera?
So we played the film on the track and we said, look at all these swear words in it. We made it at slow speed. And then we wrote down that he's saying all kinds of things which is totally not acceptable to the 12 category or the PG category. It's got to be a 15. Just because the film irritated us.
No, no.
And children were furious. Yes. Apparently parents were complaining, why is this film a 15? You know, it was just one of those things where you want to exercise a bit of...
And presumably once that's been agreed, that's where it stays.
No, sometimes they did. They didn't revoke... I can't remember if they revoked it or not, but I know that people were very cross. But I mean, you know, we had our case,
yes.
that Robin Williams was saying certain very,
yes.
very fast, you know, in his patter.
Yes, of course,
he was
probably thinking he was going to get away with it.
Yeah,
yes.
getting away. That's
yes,
right.
Yes, so. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Yes, brilliant.
And then there were other really interesting occasions. One was The Last Temptation of Christ, Scorsese's movie.
Yes.
So when you had a controversial movie, everybody had to watch it, all the censors.
And did you watch it together at the same time?
We used to watch two, usually it's two of you, mm-hmm. you know. And this time it was sent around to everybody and then you had a discussion. And this time for Last Temptation, even the administrative staff who don't have a say were brought in because it had issues to do with religion, Christianity, the you know. Theological questions, and there were people outside who were really angry, and we made our case, and that was kind of exciting. And then the other problematic thing was International Guerrillas, which wanted to kill Salman Rushdie.
Yes, I remember.
And actually Salman Rushdie said that he didn't want censorship, and so we had to negotiate with him. There was my friend who worked with me, Shah Rukh Hussain, was a Pakistani, and she had contacts with Salman, and then they negotiated that he actually didn't want censorship.
Ah, I used to work in the office next to Salman Rushdie.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we worked at the same advertising agency in the same creative department. Yes, just before, well, he'd written McKnight's Children while he worked there, so his first novel. And the review had just come out in Cosmopolitan magazine one morning when I had my copy of Cosmo, and he nicked it off me to read this obviously very glowing review, and the rest is history. But yes, he was an advertising copywriter.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
So 1989, yeah. That's when the fatwa came and all his life changed forever.
Yes, indeed. But it hasn't held him back, has it? He's gone on to great things.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to take a short break now, but join us after the break when we'll be hearing more from Barrows, and she'll be telling us more about her life in film. Okay, speak to you in a minute. Bye-bye.
The Lunchtime Social Debate, brought to you by Real Employment Law Advice, your legal lighthouse guiding you through a sea of employment law. A solicitor's firm with a difference. Go to realemploymentlawadvice.co.uk for more information.
Across the Isle of Wight and across the world, this is Vectis Radio.
White Sight is a ride-based spectacle boutique. Here's how it works. You need glasses? Take your prescription along to the friendly team in Cross Street Ride. White Sight is a boutique shop selling budget to designer frames and sunglasses. Stockists of Gucci, Dior, Dolce & Gabbana, Ray-Bans and many more. You'll be spoilt for choice. White Sight's an independent retailer, so you can shop locally and be assured of first-class service and great glasses. Visit them in Cross Street Ride or check them out on www.whitesight.co.uk.
All Washed Up are a group of friends and family brought together by toe-tapping music and fun times. Their influences stem from blues, bluegrass and skiffle genres. They also like to put their own All Washed Up twang on popular songs with an eclectic mix of banjo, mandolin, ukulele, guitar, bass, harmonica, washboard and T-chest bass. They play feel-good, foot-stomping tunes that are good for both the soul and dancing. To book All Washed Up for your event, call 01983 521 267. That's 01983 521 267. Or email DameShirleySteed@gmail.com. Or check them out at www.allwashedup.info.
The 4 P's project is for 11 to 19 year olds and up to 25 years with additional needs. Presenting, producing, promoting and podcasting. Check out www.4ps.org.uk. Sponsored by CLC, the Care Learning Centre.
It's James and Judy here, the island's version of Richard and Judy. We've been married for longer than Judy cares to mention, haven't we?
That's true, James.
And together we run Ramshackle Pop-Up Cinema from our Global Nerve Centre in Bembridge. We're bringing lots of bickering, wittering...
That's me.
...and twittering...
That's James, the technical one.
...to Vectis Radio every Wednesday afternoon from 1 to 4. And that's our show, Ramshackle Mashup. It's a heady mix of music, previews and reviews of things going on the island, including arts, and breaking news about local eateries, cycling and special places.
And film.
Stay social and get in touch. It's /Vectis Radio on Facebook. The World Wide Web never felt so local.
The Lunchtime Social Debate, brought to you by Real Employment Law Advice, your legal lighthouse guiding you through a sea of employment law. A solicitor's firm with a difference. Go to realemploymentlawadvice.co.uk for more information.
Hello and welcome back to Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and my special guest today, Barrows Gandhi. And before the break, we were talking about Barrows's career in film and TV. And I want to ask you, Barrows, I want to go back to talking about one of your biggest influences, which was that your father, because I know he was a leading light in the art world.
Yes. Joan, I think my parents, I have to say, were the biggest influence in my life, and they're dead now. They're both dead, and I sort of still talk to them as if they're there with me. It's kind of easier because I left home very early, and I used to go and visit them in India and then look after them in the last years when they were old. They lived very fortunately, till a ripe old age of... My dad was nearly 93 and my mother wow. was 90, so I had a lot of them. And they just kind of influenced me because of the way they led their life. I mean, I always realized that they were born in a golden age in India. It was just sort of... in their youth, they were fighting for independence, Indian independence. And my father, who we always joke is the boy with the golden spoon, he was sent to Cambridge, as sort of the eldest sons of the family were sent to. And then he came back on holiday in 1939. He was doing his PPE, but the war started. So the ships couldn't go back. So he was sort right. of stranded in Bombay. And then his father said, okay, what should we do for you? You can't finish your college. So he started a business for him. And it was frames, picture frame moldings. There was a Belgian man called Mr. Sepulchre who said, I've got the know-how to make these special chemical moldings. Handmade.
Yeah.
And will your son run the factory? And there was some land and they built this factory, and that's how it began in those days. This was in the early 40s. And so by the time independence came, my father was he realized he wasn't a businessman. So he had a very nice manager who looked after the business called Mr. Shah.
Uh-huh. Allowing
and
your
he
father.
Allowed him to watch everything that was going on Fantastic. Around him. And this is the sort of age. And what had happened was, this is the war, and a lot of Jewish emigres had come to India to escape Nazi Germany. And three of them were very crucial in the history of Indian art. One was a man called Walter Langhammer from Vienna. Yes. And he had a Jewish wife, so it was obvious why he had to come. Mm-hmm. Because one of his students had said, come to Bombay, so he did. Yes. When he realized that Hitler was becoming too threatening. And he was the head of the Times of India art critic. He was art critic in the Times of India. So he was sort of shaping the cultural scene there. And then there was a very intellectual man called Rudi von Leiden. And then there was a businessman called Schlesinger. And they were putting in a huge input of knowledge. And they'd have these Sunday afternoon gatherings, where people would come. So the artists who then became now the great moderns, the progressive art movement,
yes.
Names like Hussein, Raza, Souza, they were there being sort of nurtured. My father would be witness to all
just
this.
Just lapping it all up.
Yep.
Yeah, how fantastic. Yeah.
And then it kind of evolved through the 50s. And then they had there was an artist who started his own gallery. But it was all very piecemeal. There would be the Bombay Art Society. There'd be the Jahangirat Gallery that opened. But it was a bit piecemeal. And then he realized by 1963 that he had to start his own gallery. So his was the first contemporary art gallery in India.
So that's Keku Gandhi, your father.
Keku Gandhi, mm. yeah. And I was 12 at that time. And my mother then went off to have a surprise baby who was 12 years younger than me. At that time, I was the youngest in the family. And then that's my sister Shireen, who now runs the gallery today.
Right. Oh, how lovely.
That's yeah, so she was...
And is that the one you worked for as the nanny?
No, that was my older sister.
Okay.
Yeah. My older sister used to work for the gallery. She was 18, I was 12. And then she got married to the Swiss.
So is it the same gallery in the same location? Or is
no, it was a small gallery on top of a very major place called the Jahangirat Gallery. Mm-hmm. It was a very small space. And then they moved when my sister took over, really, with... Her husband bought her 5,000 square feet in Bombay, and they've got a very big gallery. And she's got the baggage of my, the good baggage of my parents, the name, the brand.
Oh, I Kemold, see. Yes, and yes. Well, that must count for an awful lot.
It does, and yeah. So she's one of the leading galleries, and she's on the board of Art Basel for the Far East, and so she's big player in the art world.
So your father, I mean, he set this all up. So that's the, him as the professional. What was he like as a person, and your mother? How did they sort of play together? What were they like? What's your memories of them?
Well, they were... I've got pictures of them when they were young. They're a very, very glamorous couple. They were very good looking, and there was that, you know, a bit like those film star pictures, those black and white pictures.
Oh, how wonderful,
you know.
Yes.
Yeah, when they were young. But by the time I knew them, they were like a very feisty couple. My mother was very, very practical and down to earth and a really hard worker. She saw her husband through, and my father had all the, but she always acknowledged that he had the vision. But he was high maintenance, my father. I think he was bipolar. You know, he once went off when I was 13. He disappeared to Europe for 6 months with no idea where he was.
Really?
In those days, there was not much communication because there was no internet or,
no,
you know,
of course not,
the
no.
phones never used to work. And he came back and he didn't even recognize me at the airport, you know. And now we've discovered letters from my mother saying how at that time they didn't even know whether they were going to get money. You know, she was really holding it all together. But of course, we lived in a joint family with my grandparents, you know.
Uh-huh. So did you ever find out why he'd gone?
Well, he was doing great things.
He was doing great things, but sort of just to go with no explanation and no communication.
He had a very coherent reason. It's just that he would be... You know, say he'd show in Geneva, and then some art dealer would say, "Well, you must have a show in Brussels," and then he would kind of link up. For instance, he came to England, and then there was a big show, and Princess Margaret opened it. You know,
yeah, so he was very single-minded.
Yeah, he was very
work.
Single. There was there was amazing things that happened, but
he was taking every opportunity.
Exactly,
yes.
And there was, you know, in those days. There was India, there was socialist India, there was no foreign exchange. People were really poor, but he was a wheeler dealer. He would get Air India to pay the flights for the paintings, and then they'd be stacked. I remember always, my sister used to say, "Oh my God, I've got so many paintings lying there." And I would have pieces of equipment lying in my flat, tiny flat in London. And my father would suddenly arrive, you know. You'd never know when he'd turn up. And he'd say, "Oh, I'm at the airport." And I'd say, "What do you mean you're at the airport?" And I said, "Well, I've come." I said, "Well, I'm going to the doctor now. You haven't warned me." So he arrives in a taxi, and then he looks for my flat. He's never been there before. And he leaves his luggage. And somebody says, "Oh, I'll look after your bag," and walks off with the bag. You know, my father's sort of dramas every time.
All of his own making, by the sounds of it. And of course, he knew that in your mother, like you say, you had this sort of hardworking, very efficient woman that could take care of business while he was away.
Yeah.
So he could just go off on these, not so much flights of fancy, were they? Because he was always very single-minded, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Eye on the prize, by the sounds
That's
of it.
That's it, yeah. Which we didn't appreciate. I mean, I think now I understand more and more. I mean, I was always very angry with my father as a child because, first of all, I was second daughter. There was the elder sister who was his pride and joy, and I was kind of ignored a bit. And but he made up for it later.
Yes.
And once in school, he was just asked to pick me up halfway on Marine Drive. I was waiting for 2 hours. I didn't have any money, and I was just dependent on my father coming to pick me up.
Yes.
I was stranded. You know, this or the
yes.
And then my mother said, "I can never trust you with anything." You know. But
they made a great team by the sound of it.
Yeah, yeah. But by the 30s, I began to understand my dad.
Mm. Do you think you've got a lot of your dad in you?
Yeah, I think so. I think I get a bit reckless also.
But in terms of where that took you, that those huge influences from your sort of creative side of your father and this huge practicality, get the job done of your mother, you know, this has taken you to sort of great places, hasn't it, through your own career and your own life?
I think, you know, one thing I thought, and I was very conscious of, when I left England, India in 1970s, I want to get away from the privileged background that I come from, because in Bombay everybody, "Oh, you're Keku's daughter, oh, you're Keku." And I thought, I'll never make my own thing. I'll get a job because I'm so-and-so's daughter. So I thought, I'll make my way in England, where I, with literally £50 in my pocket, I came. You know, it was very tough. There was no way they could send money easily. Sometimes
that was very brave of you.
Yeah, and but you're mad when you're 20.
Of course
you don't
you are.
You don't
Absolutely.
Even think about things like that.
If my daughter's listening, did you hear that? Barrow said you're mad when you're 20, Sophie. Yes, do carry on.
And it's it was just that thing that I took those risks.
You know no fear at that age,
yeah,
do you? And everything
yeah.
you think everything's going to be fine.
I used to cycle all around central London, which I can't imagine now.
But
without
people
a
do
helmet.
Now, don't they? With their old Boris
bikes and
everything.
More I know, than ever. But now I can't believe I did it, you know.
It was very different then, though.
Yeah.
Far less cars on the road, far less hectic. But can we talk a bit about, because I'm very conscious of time, but I really want to know more about your films, and particularly the feature you made for the BBC called Flight.
Right. Okay, so what happened was, I'll quickly encapsulate my film career.
Yeah,
because
please.
So, in 1982, something amazing happened in Britain. Very exciting time. Channel 4 was beginning.
Oh, yes, I remember them launching.
And we were, my partner, who's called Rosie Thomas, we had done a series of Indian films for... She was doing her PhD on Indian cinema, and I joined up with her. I was at the BFI, and we did a series called Hindi Pictures for the ICA Cinema, a season of films, you know, popular Indian films, because she was interested in that, and I got interested. And Channel 4 came up to us and said, look, we like you too. We could talk to you. We can't talk to all these crazy Indian producers who all claim they have rights. Will you buy films for us to show on Channel 4? So that's how we started a company called Hindi Picture,
uh-huh.
which was a pun on In the Picture.
Yes.
And we took it all like a bit of a joke. The Johnny Rotten's was a lawyer, was our lawyer, and he used to find us very amusing, two women, you know. And it was all... And then suddenly, when Channel 4 started, we realized, hey, this is great. We helped somebody make a program about Indian films, a company. We gave them our knowledge, and then we wanted to do our own producing, you know. So Farooq Dhondi at that time was the commissioning editor, and I plagued him from 1986. I kept knocking on his door saying, I want to do this, I want to do this. And he would humor me.
Yes.
And then finally in 88, he gave us a pilot. And then in 89, and then in 1990, finally, I got a show, which was actually quite remarkable when you think two women who had no experience
yes.
in television doing a series for Channel 4 called On the Other Hand. And we had a star presenter. That was what got the series greenlit, Shekhar Kapoor, who at that time was not famous in England, but he made Bandit Queen on the backs of our program,
right.
you know.
Yes.
And so we did this show called On the Other Hand, which was about issues in the Asian community.
So was that like a chat show?
A chat show.
Yes.
Yeah. And it was great. All these topics that you talk about now, we were talking about because Salman Rushdie's fatwa had happened in 89. We started getting information. We were really... we had our links in the community. We had researchers and things. We'd have these discussions yeah. just like... And people would tell us about how in the mosques, you know, dangerous things were happening. And I was saying long before in the 90s that very, very... You know, there's some very nasty people about. And this sort of separate schools business, I saw that as a very threatening thing that shouldn't have separate schools.
So you
schools.
Were privy to an awful lot of inside information.
Yeah. yeah. And so and then also we were very, India was boiling over at that time with the whole issue about the Ayodhya mosque that was destroyed by the Hindu fundamentalists. So that politics also became, so we were allowed to do a lot of political programs about that and about Pakistan, religion and politics, equality of women, race, gangs, education. So we mixed marriage. Our first show was about mixed marriage, and we talked about, you know, really difficult issues. We were told homosexuality. We did a pilot on
all
that.
All these topics were really...
Yeah, they were taboo. And Farooq basically told her, Farooq Dhondi, he said, talk the untalkable.
Exactly,
you know,
because that's what Channel 4 was all about. It was
yeah.
part of their remit, wasn't it?
So we talked about racism in the Asian community, you know, about black people and,
yes.
you know, all the uncomfortable things. And then we were on the map as a television company, and then I got a very fortunate thing of doing this film for the BBC. They were looking for an independent company, and they had developed this film, which won a prize for the best writer, Tanika Gupta, black Asian writer, and I was asked to produce it. So that's how I got the opportunity to make this film, Flight, which is about honor killings, which is again very topical.
Yes.
And it's only been seen on television. So
what year was that, Beres?
That it was made in 95, shown in 98.
And that was shown on the BBC?
Yeah, BBC Two.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what kind of feedback did you get from that?
We got a lot of feedback. It wasn't as topical as it is now, interestingly. No. It was still one of those things that people thought about happened and didn't really know about.
That's,
you know,
right. Or maybe didn't perhaps quite believe.
Impinge on, yes, people, the, yes, way it's done subsequently.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, people were not that aware.
And
so,
perhaps a little bit sceptical.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. But what I loved about the script and why I took the script was, first of all, it was very doable for a very small amount of money. We only had $500,000, which is not a lot of money to do it.
No, not at all.
And it was written from a point of view of a mother supporting her daughter against a father and sending out the bounty hunter, who was a cousin, to destroy his daughter once he realized she was going out. She was a Hindu going out with Muslim. It was
unbelievable.
I mean, it was, yeah, it's a very everyday story today. I mean, it's very common. But first of all, it wasn't a Muslim girl, it was a Hindu girl, you know. And it happens in all the communities, you know.
Was this based on one specific case, or was it,
well, Tanika, I believe she used to work for a refuge in the north, and so she really used the experience of working in a refuge to write the script. And I don't want to give too much away,
no,
because I'm hoping to show the film.
That's
sometime.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
So presumably, because you were the producer, it's your film.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
you can show it as and when you
yeah, please. Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah. So you're hoping to show it here on the island?
Yeah, hoping to show it. We're just trying to sort out licenses and stuff like that.
Brilliant.
You know, somewhere where we can show it.
Because that's a 70-minute feature, isn't it?
It's a 70-minute, yeah.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah.
And it's got, you know, great star cast. It's got Meena Anwar,
uh-huh,
as the main actress, the girl who runs away. It's got Neena Wadia, who's in Goodness Gracious,
yes,
Me.
Yes, I know.
It's got Meera Sayal.
Yes, and she was in Goodness Gracious
and
Me.
And Kulvinder Singh.
Yes.
And Roshan Seth, who plays the father. And he won a prize for it. And we won a prize in France, and we won the Emma, the first Emma, for the best television production, which was the Ethnic Minority
Wonderful.
Media Award. Yeah,
yeah, that is certainly something to be very, very proud of. So are you still in touch with the cast?
I'm in touch, thanks to Facebook. Facebook brings back all your past.
Of course, in a good and a bad way.
Yeah, in a good, yeah. So I, you know, so Adil and Meena is very keen to come down if we do have
wouldn't that be fantastic
to have a screening, and because she said it was a film before her, you know, it's before its time and very topical,
and before
today.
She was famous here,
yeah, yeah, so yeah. She'll come down and be the star guest.
Lovely. Brilliant.
Yeah.
And I think we were talking earlier, and obviously to be a film producer, you know, it's wonderful, but as with all those careers in the arts, you often need more than one string to your bow, don't you?
Yeah, so what I started to do afterwards, I had lots of offers of work after Flight. I did something for the Arts Council, which was called Surviving Sabu, with another very talented writer called Ian Iqbal Rashid. And that was a small film, and that's called Surviving Sabu. And then I was approached by somebody who had money from the BBC and what was then the Film Council to produce a big feature film, which was very interesting for me. It was called Undercurrents, and it was about community up in Manchester and how. And it was a private detective story. It was kind of, you know, which I love that genre.
Yeah.
And about him trying to avoid all the extremes that were going on. Interestingly, before 9/11 happened, and then even afterwards, it was very topical. But sadly, we've never managed to crack the script. So it's a project that I've changed four writers with, you know, got money for, but it's not got off the ground. So these are the, you know, the highs and the lows,
yes,
you know.
Yes, of course. There's so many stumbling potential blocks. Stumbling
yeah.
blocks
on and
there.
Then there was another project that I was very interested, which was made, set in Bombay in 68 when I was a schoolgirl, which was chasing George Harrison when he was in town. And so I was trying to raise money for that, and I'd go to the Cannes Film Festival, Berlin Film Festival. It was very, very hard. So in the end, I decided I'm going to write that myself.
Yes.
I don't know where it'll go. I don't know how I'll... But I'm really having a blast when I get moments of inspiration, which is really actually sitting down on your desk and doing the hard work.
But there's no substitute for that.
There's no getting away from it.
Doing the work. Yeah, and it's that work ethic that you get from your father and clearly your mum
well, there's not enough of it in me, I'm afraid, but I'm trying to... I do other things over here. I go to the beach and...
It's a great distraction, isn't it?
Yeah, and I, of course, I live in London, so I have to go back, you know, so I'm back and forth a lot, travelling a lot.
Which direction do you like going best in? Back to London or coming back to the island?
I have to say back to the island.
Yes, it's always, isn't it? It's like, going home.
I mean, I have to go to London because that's technically where I live, you know, and so I've got my doctors there and everything. But I do, I love being on the island. And I've discovered my passion for bridge. I love cards, and so I get out of the house and I play lots of bridge.
Oh, excellent, excellent. And can I just, we've got just a couple of minutes left, and I'm just very interested in, you know, your father when he got older, because he lived, like you say, till 93, I think you said. Did he keep his faculties right to the end?
You know, my father... You could write a book just about how he morphed into old age. He was so clever. He pretended to be having a lot of dementia, and all his outrageous acts, he would pretend, oh, he's an old man. And India is very tolerant of older people, much more than here.
That's
here,
right.
He'd be locked up in the loony bin. The things he did when he was old. We live in a part of Bombay, with this old family house, you know. My great-grandfather built it, and it's now next to this big actor, Shah Rukh Khan, and he would be wandering up the walkway. There's a lovely walkway, and all his friends, everybody knew him. You'd go on the thing with him, and then you'd hear these stories about what he'd do. He'd pull some woman's hair and say, she said, why did you pull my hair? And he said, I just wanted to see that lovely black flowing hair.
Oh.
You know? Or he'd... And if he didn't like somebody, he'd slap them.
Oh, right. Do you think he was kind of very cleverly getting his own back for a few...
Setting
a few scores?
The people he slapped were people who deserved a slap, because there was somebody in the art world who I will not mention who he gave a tight slap to.
Okay.
And all the artists trooped up to us to give him a hug.
Oh, so he'd just kind of been waiting for that moment when nobody could have any, there was no retribution. It was just, oh,
and of course,
bless him.
He could get away with it because he had, you know, he's an old man.
Yes, yes. So he was probably a lot smart as a whip right till the end.
Very, 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 very. My sister's husband said he's smarter than any of you. He pretends he's sitting over there, but he is much cleverer than the whole lot of you.
Yes. But it must have been, such a loss to the art world when he died.
Yeah, and I mean, there was a wonderful tributes to him, and we had great... thing.
And it's lovely that your sisters kept that legacy going.
They're very fortunate, you know.
And obviously, you know, he lives on through all of you, the children.
Yeah.
So there was four of you or three of you?
Four.
Four of you, yeah.
Eldest is a brother and then three sisters.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Well, it's been... So what's next for you, quickly? What's your next?
Oh, well, the thing that I suddenly decided... Last week, I went to Berlin, and before that, I thought, right, I've got to do something very unfinished business. So this script will go on for a long time, but I thought all the filming that I did of my father, which I have gathered from 2002, and it's got to be made into a film. So I've got an editor, and I'm going to work on the film.
Oh, that sounds... So is this based on some early interviews you did?
Early
with
interviews
him?
With
So you've
him.
Got those?
Both of them, yeah. And,
oh, fantastic.
And lots of Indian artists as well, and people in the art
How
world.
How lovely. Oh, yeah. That's brilliant. So you're going to bring him back to life for the rest of us who were never lucky enough to meet him.
Yeah.
Yeah, how fantastic. Well, it's been absolutely... absolutely wonderful talking to you. Thank you so much. It's been really interesting, Bearrows. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Pleasure. And perhaps you'll come back once the film is, you've written it, and come back and talk to us again and tell us how you're getting on.
Yeah.
That'd be lovely.
Great.
Thank
okay.
you. So join me next week when I'll be talking to Vic Slothian, not just the Green candidate, but a very multi-talented lady. And I've just been told, actually, by Bearrows that she's heard Vic play the accordion and seen her do it. So, you know, it's kind of like patting your head and rubbing your tummy. It's one of those things that just utterly defeats me. So let alone everything else that Vic gets up to. So I can't wait to speak to her and hear what she's got to say. So please tune in again next Friday between 1 and 2. But don't leave us now. Stay with us. And just let us be the backdrop to your weekend, because it's going to be sunny and beautiful. Okay, thanks again for listening. Bye-bye now. Take care.